This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Your Inner Critic is a Big Jerk and Other Truths About Being Creative. Written and performed by Danielle Crissa.
To everyone who is determined to live a creative life, no matter what the jerks say. Introduction. This is an incredibly white, empty page, and you're the one who's supposed to fill it? You can't write a whole book. Hello, you're not even a writer? Seriously, such a jerk. When I was given the green light to write this book, I was beyond thrilled. I had so many ideas that I could not wait to share. I thought I'd jump right into this exciting new adventure with no fear. But I have to admit that I procrastinated in as many ways as I possibly could. Kickoff meeting with one of my most favorite artists in the world, Martha Rich? Check. Rereading my initial pitch 50 times? Check. Purchase of hot pink notebook to capture all of my brilliant ideas? Check. Yet days rolled into weeks, deadlines loomed, and the thrilling, terrifying task remained undone. I thought I'd have no self-doubt while writing this book. I was excited. I was ready. Things changed when I came face-to-face with the blank white rectangle and blinking cursor of Microsoft Word. There was a small, all right, fairly large panic attack, and a very long lecture from my inner critic. I've had issues with my inner critic for decades. I'm pretty sure it stems from a terrible critique that I had in my last year of art school. More on that later, 20-plus years ago. Thankfully, that experience is probably what led to the launching of my art blog, The Jealous Curator, in 2009. I love my site, and it has changed my life in many ways. I went from feeling completely alone in my creative jealousy to being surrounded by thousands of supportive, like-minded readers. By sharing the work of contemporary artists that initially had made me jealous, I slowly began to realize that there is absolutely no need to be jealous. There is a place for anyone who wants to be creative. Somewhere along the way, that toxic, soul-crushing jealousy turned into inspirational, get-your-ass-back-into-the-studio motivation. What a relief. I was slowly starting to figure it all out. Then, what brought things into focus for me was Creative Block, the first book I wrote. Well, you didn't really write it. You interviewed a bunch of artists from around the world. They wrote it. You just asked the questions. How hard can that be? Sorry, that was my inner critic again. Anyway, as I was saying before I was so rudely interrupted, in Creative Block, I asked full-time successful artists about blocks, self-doubt, and the dreaded inner critic. I had no idea how they would answer my questions. I assumed that most of them would respond with, "Inner critic? Ah, no, I don't have that. Inner critics are for amateurs." But their collective answers stunned me. People who I had assumed had this whole creative thing figured out actually felt just like me, and like you, and every other creative person in the world. We all get blocked. We are all plagued by an inner critic, and no one is immune to the creativity-halting effects of negative criticism. It's true, and as I traveled around promoting Creative Block, hearing the stories of hundreds of people, I found myself knee-deep in a pile of truths about what it meant to be a creative person. 10 truths, in fact, one for each chapter of this book. These truths run the gamut, from dealing with soul-crushing negative criticism to quieting bitter inner critics. We'll face the fact that a blank page can be absolutely terrifying and learn how to navigate around it. We'll talk about turning green-eyed jealousy into a green light for your creativity, about failing until we're geniuses, and about the importance of finding a group of trusted people with whom to share our work and our journey. I wrote this book because I want every creative person to know that we are all part of a huge, amazing, talented group of people. We know that being a creative person can feel quite isolating, but none of us is actually alone. Everyone has experienced some, if not all, of these truths along the way, even the professionals. But people rarely talk about it, hence feeling alone. Read this book from start to finish, or jump around from chapter to chapter. Find the stories that strike a chord with you and your creative pursuits. I made sure to leave a little extra room in the margins of this book for jotting down thoughts or realizations that may pop into your head as you read. I'm a big fan of taking notes, says the girl with a hot pink notebook. I hope that these 10 truths bring you the clarifying, freeing aha moments that I've experienced, thanks to the openness and honesty of so many of you. See you on the other side. Chapter 1. Everyone is creative. Art facts. First, art is fun. Then, art is creative. Finally, Art is beautiful. Art! Esme, age 6. Very wise words from a very smart little girl. Whether you paint or sing or write or dance, I'm sure you remember feeling that kind of joy, even if it is a bit foggy now. That's why we need clever kids like Esme to remind us that everyone, and I mean everyone, is creative. That's a fact. Every single one of us is born with an imagination and a primal urge to make things. Things like fire and cities and cakes and books and shoes and vegetable gardens and breakfast. There are a ridiculous number of ways to be creative. Look at you, for example. Whether you're currently living a creative life or not, you want to. There's no way you'd pick up a book about inner critics and other truths about being creative if you weren't creative. I wish I had a dollar for every time someone said, "Me? No, I'm not creative." I would be a gazillionaire. The thing is, that's not really them talking. It's their jerk-face inner critic. Okay, so maybe you haven't made anything in a very long time, but that doesn't mean you're not creative. What it means is that somewhere along the way, you became really good at saying, "Me? No, I'm not creative." Cha-ching! There's another dollar in my pocket. If you feel that way, let's change your mind. Find the fun. I'm going to ask you to take a deep breath, relax your shoulders, and think back to when you were little. To a time when you drew and wrote and sang and put on plays for the sole purpose of having fun. Ah, those were the days. We were completely free to be creative. We stuck macaroni onto feathers with glitter glue simply because we knew it would be amazing. We created homemade books because there was a story that had to be told. There was no pressure to be published and no need to worry about what galleries might be looking for this year. It was before any of us cared about getting into art school or having our work written about. That said, not everyone has warm, sunny memories of childhood creativity, and I have a theory about that. I don't want to get ahead of myself. See Chapter 7, No One Can Wrestle the Pencil Out of Your Hand. But perhaps one of the reasons people tell themselves, "Me? No, I'm not an artist," is that someone else said it first. Perhaps a cranky first grade teacher held up that macaroni feather masterpiece in front of the entire class and deemed it a glittery mess. This makes me so angry. And FYI, stories like that are ridiculously common. Every child is an artist. The problem is how to remain an artist once we grow up. Pablo Picasso. Are you an artist? I ask this question a lot. Generally, this question is met with a pause and a slightly blank look. In that moment, I can almost hear the inner dialogue. I'm an artist? Well, no, I make stuff, sometimes. But an artist with a capital A? I want to say yes, but that would be terrifying. What actually comes out of the person's mouth is usually, not really. I should mention that this answer and those blank looks are always from adults. When I ask kids the same question, I get a very different response. It goes a little something like this. Me. Are you an artist? Kid. Yes. No hesitation, no thinking it over first. They have never sold a painting or published a story, but they have absolutely no problem answering me with a loud, resounding yes. And here's an even more interesting tidbit. Even professional artists don't always answer that question with confidence. In my first book, Creative Block, I asked all 50 of the very accomplished visual artists that I interviewed how they felt about the title of artist. Here are a couple of their answers. Jessica Bell, Canadian mixed media artist. Question. How do you feel about describing yourself as an artist? Answer. The feeling that I'm an artist is still pretty elusive to me, rather like the feeling of being a grown-up. But other people tell me that I'm an artist, and I tell myself that I'm an artist, regardless of how I feel. Camilla Engman, Swedish painter, illustrator. Question. Describe the first time you truly felt like an artist. Answer. I still have my doubts. Perhaps that's modesty talking, but isn't it interesting that yes doesn't come quickly and easily? It is a little reassuring, though, to realize that these successful, full-time, working artists have to convince themselves that they too deserve this title. Calling yourself an artist may be something that you need to work on. Quite literally. I've started practicing in the mirror. Yes, I'm an artist. I'm a collage artist? Note, try not to make it sound like a question next time. Trey Spiegel, a very successful New York-based artist who has worked on projects with Stella McCartney and Michelle Obama, told me an amazing story around owning it. This is how Trey learned how to use the A word. I got a job working for a magazine at age 17, while I was still in high school. I was an art director by age 19, and at 21, somehow, I ended up in New York at Vogue. I was friends with a lot of artists, photographers, and performers in New York City in the mid-80s, but I had a real job. So I kept making art on the side while working at my day job. Until I inherited my dead friend's paint-by-number collection and merged it with the word art I was doing at the time, I really never even thought of calling myself the A-word. I had so many successful artist friends like Keith Haring and Kenny Scharf, etc., that I couldn't really call myself one and mean it. I think the first time I ever admitted it was filling out one of those landing forms when you were re-entering the U.S. I wrote artist under occupation. I was sure that the agent was going to see right through me and ask for proof. I did that again and again, until I could finally say it out loud. I'm an artist. It doesn't matter if anybody else thinks you're an artist. If you believe it and say it, then you are. That's how it works. Yes, I will totally do that on my next flight, and I won't include a question mark. Nurtured versus not so much. The people closest to us when we're young are often the ones who give us our creative confidence, whether they realize it or not. When I was 3, my mom, who was a very accomplished painter, let me use her oil pastels. Risky with a preschooler, but she was always very generous with her supplies, no matter how messy they were. I did a drawing of a very big bird on a very little tree. As I was working on the finishing touches, a tiny yellow sun in the top left corner, of course, my dad leaned over my shoulder for a closer look. He picked it up and said, "Well, we need to frame this." He set up all of the special tools and supplies that he used when he framed my mom's work. He even cut a custom fancy gold frame for my masterpiece. I remember this like it was yesterday. I remember the overwhelming pride I felt. I remember thinking and believing, I am a real artist now. Clearly, fancy gold frames from your parents have a lot of power. I still have this drawing hanging in my studio today, and it's still awesome. Teachers have an enormous influence as well. I heard renowned Canadian painter Ian Wallace speak at an event at Emily Carr University in Vancouver. He told the story of his very first breakthrough, the moment he realized that he could be an artist when he grew up. In 1953, Ian was 9 years old, and his family was about to move away from his very small town. He had always liked art in school, but hadn't given it much thought. His teacher, on the other hand, saw great potential. And so, as his going-away gift, the class presented him with an oil paint set, a real one, for grown-ups. Until that moment, it had never occurred to Ian that being an artist was something he could actually do. His wonderfully supportive teacher and that oil paint kit were the beginning of his path toward a very successful, lifelong career as an influential Canadian artist. Sadly, not everyone is nurtured in that department. Without support and encouragement from a young age, it's difficult to keep those creative fires burning. Support, or lack thereof, can make a shocking difference in how you view yourself creatively. Yes, I know you're not supposed to care what other people say or think about your work, but we're human, and it's hard not to care. When we were kids, we used our imaginations with complete confidence, but the moment that someone else told us that our creations weren't good enough or, I think you're a better athlete than an artist, that outside influence started to change how we saw our creative selves. Because of this, many of us give up on our creative pursuits much, much too soon. We'll talk more about those unwanted bits of criticism later, but the reason I mention them here is just to say, if you believe you're not creative because someone told you that years ago, it doesn't mean that you can't find your way back to a time when being creative truly was fun. Here are a few projects that will take you back there right now. Projects from the kindergarten drawer. Macaroni masterpiece. Grab one bag of hard noodles, macaroni, wheels, shells, something fun, pom-poms, feathers, glitter, anything you can find in your house or dollar store, construction paper, cardstock, and most important, glue. I don't need to say anything else, do I? Let the magic begin. Fresh air foraging. Go for a walk and look for artifacts that you can collect and bring home. Rocks, bottle caps, and flowers or leaves that you can press in a book. Whatever you can find, stack it up or arrange it on a piece of paper, and then photograph your final composition. You can stop right there, or you can use this photo of found bits and pieces as a starting point for a collage, painting, sculpture, story, or poem. pancake pictures. Get yourself a funnel and a hot pan. Pour the pancake batter through the funnel and draw yourself some breakfast. Animals, flowers, the Eiffel Tower, anything. The fantastic thing about this fun weekend morning project that even if it looks terrible, it will still taste delicious. Add whipped cream as needed. Blind contour buddies. You can do this in a mirror or with a friend. Look at your reflection, or at your friend, and draw the image without looking at the paper. And, if you want to make it even trickier, don't lift your marker off the page. It will be crazy and look nothing like your subject, but that's kind of the idea. It's not meant to look perfect. In fact, it's impossible for that to happen. This is a fun thing to do at a dinner party over drinks. Well, there you have it. Art is fun. There are no rules and no way that you can make a mistake. All these projects exist purely for the joy of creating. No pressure, just silly. An excuse to open a fresh box of crayons. And there's not one cranky first grade teacher in sight to give her unsolicited opinion. No such thing as too late. Far too often people tell me, I wish I hadn't given up on art, or dancing, acting, writing, music. But it's too late now. What? Why? I don't believe that for a second. Many amazingly talented people didn't hit their stride until their 30s, 40s, or later. As far as famous painters go, you don't have to be a child prodigy to be considered one of the greats. Vincent van Gogh didn't start painting until his late 20s, and Claude Monet didn't find success until his mid-30s. Late in life for both of them, considering that the average life expectancy was around 45. And what about kitchen maven Julia Child? She only began cooking in her late 30s and didn't publish her first cookbook until she was 50. One of my favorite stories, Minnie Pearl, an Aboriginal artist whose paintings are shown in prestigious galleries all over Australia, started painting when she turned 80. Yes, I said 80. See, it's never too late to jumpstart your creativity. Have you always wanted to paint? Paint. Sign up for a class or just get yourself some supplies and start experimenting. You've always dreamed of being on stage? Join a community theater. You don't have to be the star out of the gate or sell your first painting for $10,000. Just be creative because it brings you joy. Own your creativity. Creativity comes in so many shapes and sizes. All too often we equate being creative with painting perfect portraits or writing the next great American novel. Why do we do that to ourselves? Throw all of those stupid, sorry, but they are stupid, thoughts out the window and decide what being creative means to you. Maybe cake decorating is your jam. Maybe it's the thrill of taking photos from a point of view that is solely your own. Or perhaps you find a tremendous sense of creative freedom in your garden. You might not even know where your sweet spot is right now, but I hope that by the end of this book you feel excited, supported, and ready to stand up and say, me? Yes, I'm very creative. If your jerk of an inner critic disagrees, shut it down immediately. We'll talk about how to do that in Chapter 6. Regardless of your past experiences, I know that there is one fantastic creative memory that you'll never forget. You know the one I'm talking about. When you start to hear your inner critic whispering in your ear, find a quiet spot, take a deep breath, close your eyes, and transport yourself back to that moment. Remember the joy. Remember the pride you felt in yourself for creating that amazing, insert crazy creative thing here. Remember Esme's wise words, art is fun. Now come back, bringing along a little bit of that magic in your back pocket, and get to work. Chapter 2, Excuses Are the Enemy. The lighting isn't quite right here. Work is really busy right now. The house is a mess. You should get to the gym. Have you gone grocery shopping this week? Oh look, a cute video of a baby duck sleeping on a dog. You should totally watch that before you do anything else. Excuses. So many excuses to prevent you from doing something creative today. Do you know who I blame? Yes, that jerk of an inner critic. All right, fine, you might actually be busy at work, and you haven't done the dishes since Tuesday. But if you want to find time to be creative, you can. Unfortunately, the second your sneaky inner critic gets a whiff of procrastination, it pounces. A million excuses dumped on the table, burying any chance you might have of making something anytime soon. No matter how elaborate the excuse, this chapter gives you tools for prioritizing your creativity. It's time to take that simmering pot off the back burner and bring it to a full freaking boil. Valid excuses, schmalid excuses. There are lots of valid excuses to call on, and we all use them. But obviously, people work past them, or we'd be living in a world without art, books, songs, or movies. I knew my own list of excuses, but I wondered if I was the only person clever enough to blame my dogs, or the temperature in my studio, or the brightness of the sun, or, well, you get the idea. So I reached out to my readers and asked, what is the best excuse you use to keep your creative life on the back burner? I received hundreds of responses. Some answers were funny, others were heartbreaking, but all were totally honest, and all too familiar. Amateurs and professionals jumped at the chance to share the lies they tell themselves. Lies that, strangely, fit quite neatly into four buckets. Here are a handful of the answers that I got back. Buckets of lies we tell ourselves. Bucket number one, fear. I'm so afraid of failing. It won't turn out the way I imagined anyway. I just leafed through a book about X, any inspiring artist will do, and I'll never be able to make such impressive work. So many ideas, but I don't know how to execute them perfectly the first time. I could spend hours making crap and wasting resources, and that would be depressing. Best to leave these ideas swirling in my head, which is depressing. There are so many real artists out there who could do it better. Why bother? Everything I make sucks. I should stop until I come up with something that doesn't suck. I have to get it right in my head first before I commit it to paper. In my head, it looks way better than I could ever possibly make it. Others can execute my ideas better than I can. I'm not a trained artist. I'm worried that people might not like what I paint, so why bother? Because what if this is my last idea ever? Bucket number two, the blame game. My Nespresso machine is out of capsules. The cat was sleeping on my sketchbook. My parents think it's too weird. I can't paint while anyone is home. They distract me. Best to wait till the house is quiet. Then, when the house is quiet, I catch up on dishes, etc. A cookie makes a great fall guy, especially when it's already been eaten and can't defend itself. I'm too tired from my day job, childcare, any activity. The cat will not move off the paints. I feel guilty making art when I have so much to do for other people. My iPhone is holding me captive. My kids deserve homemade food more than I deserve to paint for 3 hours. Because someone outside is playing the bagpipes and I can't concentrate. My chihuahua won't get off my lap. Everyone else needs me more. Bucket number three, environment issues. I can't concentrate with my house so messy. Then, after I clean it, I don't want to make another mess. I'll clean up the studio today. Tomorrow I'll do some work. Repeat all the time. I have nowhere to work. My bedroom is too small. The basement is too dark. If I had a room with big windows and light, I would be painting all the time. I know I'm lying to myself with this excuse. The light isn't right. I have more paintings than walls. The sun is too bright, which is a pathetic excuse since all I yearn for is a light-filled studio. My desk is so messy, I can't find my paints. It's going to be too big and I don't have room to store it. Almost every day I put off getting started early because it's just too bright in there. Get a window shade? That would be far too easy. This apartment is too small to accomplish anything. I don't have enough space in here. This is typically followed by a mini tantrum of sorts. I'll start as soon as I get my workspace organized, or painted, or set up a dream shed with white walls and big windows, lots of shelves, and an espresso machine. It'll also take a while for the honeysuckle to grow around the doorframe, but then there'll be no stopping me. Bucket number four, time. Not enough of it, wasting it. I need more than 30 minutes to make anything worthwhile. I don't have time for the paint to dry. By the time I get to the studio, I'll hardly have time to do anything before I need to go home. I'll just go tomorrow. There's no point in starting now because I'll just have to stop in 3 hours to go to work. Even if I start something, I won't have time to finish it. It's too late in the day to get started. I need to find that reference. I think I pinned it on Pinterest. I've got to reply to this one last email, repeat 1,000 times. I'll just keep listening to music until the painting comes to me. I need to think it through first. Think a bit more. And more. Gotta sit down with a cup of tea. But there's no milk. Run to the store for milk. Oh, and I need eggs, cheese, veggies. Might as well make lunch first. My art supplies are so pretty, so I need to organize them before I start my next piece of art. Huh? I didn't know I had all of these pencils. I should sharpen all of them right now, meticulously. I put the pro in procrastination. Well, that sounds familiar to me. Although I don't have a cat, apparently they sit on a lot of supplies. From the black hole that is the internet to all of that annoying sunshine streaming through the window, we managed to find the perfect excuse to slam the brakes on our own creativity. I don't love that my readers feel like this, but there is some comfort in knowing that everyone, even professionals, has a list of excuses ready to pull out at a moment's notice. Coming up with a list of elaborate excuses like these takes time, and actually a lot of creativity. Just imagine if we gave the same kind of thought and attention to our actual creative endeavors, who knows what might happen. Are you serious? If you're serious about being a creative person, then be serious about it. Yes, this is the tough love portion of the book. You can use day-to-day busyness as an excuse for not living a creative life, or you can take control and make time. Don't put your creative life on the back burner when regular life gets busy. It might stay back there for far too long until it evaporates and you're left with a burnt pot. Keep it on simmer and be sure to bring it to a full boil at least once a week. That may mean that you have to schedule your creative time. Okay, not very romantic, but it's more realistic than thinking you'll drop everything the moment inspiration strikes. We all know that rarely works out. You have to choose to make creativity a priority in your life. Here are a few suggestions to help you stay on the path, even when life gets in the way. Add creativity to your calendar. Every single day, there will be 1,000 things you feel like you need to do, should be doing, want to do. Sometimes it gets so overwhelming you think you should just throw in the towel and do nothing. Hello, daytime TV. When I started writing this book, for example, I was feeling beyond overwhelmed. How could I possibly write 10 chapters? When would I have time? I'm a full-time graphic designer, and I have a kid, and a husband, and friends, and a house that needs to be cleaned, and a garden that really should get weeded before it completely takes over. Everything was my number one priority, and every time I worked on something other than the book, I felt guilty. And of course, when I was working on the book, I felt guilty for ignoring all of the other things on my to-do list. I was at the end of my rope. I decided to make a major change. I declared that Thursday would be book day. That entire day was blocked off for the book and the book alone. No emailing, no design work, no gardening. Our family even made Thursday takeout night so that I could work right up until 6 p.m. without having to stop to help make dinner. What a relief. How can you make creativity your number one priority some of the time? If you have a Monday to Friday day job and can't declare every Thursday to be your creative day, find another time frame that works. A friend of mine sets her alarm clock for 5 a.m. Ouch. And makes art until 7:30 a.m. when it's time to get her girls up and out the door to school and herself off to work. She finds those early artsy mornings to herself totally invigorating and a wonderful way to kickstart her day. Maybe you carve out Saturday afternoons with a strategic call to the pizza delivery guy around 7 p.m. Or if you're really flowing, a bowl of cereal might do the trick. If you can schedule regular meetings at work and time at the gym and grocery shopping, then you can schedule this. It may help to delegate some of your other tasks to members of your family. If that's not an option for you, take stock of how you're spending your time. Are there things you can let go of? Could you reduce your screen time to make more room for your art? Note, make sure the time you block out for this is actually the time of day when you feel most creative. I've discovered that I don't get into the zone until about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and then I could go till 2 a.m. So for me, setting the alarm for 5 a.m. would make no sense. I spend my mornings doing paperwork, running errands, and all of those other excuse-inducing jobs. Then, at 2 p.m., when my creative fires start burning, I'm ready. Play around with this a little bit until you find your sweet spot, and then block it off in your calendar. Set deadlines. So many professional artists, designers, and writers have told me that one of their biggest motivators is a big, fat, juicy deadline. Get out your calendar and mark a big red X on the day that you're going to be finished with whatever it is you really want to finish. If you don't trust yourself to see that through, have a friend or family member give you a deadline and assign them the task of checking in on you. Get a room. This is one of the biggest complaints/excuses from creative people. I don't have any room to work. I have to set up and then clean up every single time I make something. Yes, that can be a huge, annoying problem. There are ways around it, though. Carve out a little corner of one room and set it up so all of your essential supplies are within reach. It doesn't need to be large. It helps if you surround yourself with some things that inspire you into action. I actually had a studio in a closet once. Okay, it was a little cramped, but it did the trick. There are all sorts of space-saver half tables that get mounted to a wall and fold flat when you're not using them. Google it. And if you don't have even one corner to spare, then take a look around your town for studio spaces. You can often find shared community spaces that are much more affordable than a private studio. Granted, you'll still have to convince yourself that it's not too late, or too early, or too dark, or too light to get down there at least once a week. But you know how to handle that now, right? Form habits. Hand letter a quote from a newspaper every day. Do a photograph a day project. Take the headline from the top of your local newspaper and write one paragraph. Do this at the same time every day. Committing to these daily habits will accomplish two very important things. First, it makes you incredibly present. As these projects become habits, you'll find that you've started to notice more of the world around you. Even your walk to work is a chance to be creative. You'll have to keep your eyes open, because now you're always looking for a bit of inspiration for that day's assignment. Second, these habits make creativity part of your everyday experience. If you do something creative, even a little something, every day, before you know it, you'll be living a truly creative life. So what are you waiting for? Start a 30-day challenge today. And by today, I mean today. Invite a group of friends to do it with you if you like. It's fun, and it will keep you honest. See Chapter 8, Failure Leads to Genius. I've given a list of 30 things for you to photograph or draw or write about this month. Now you have no excuse not to do it. See, more of that tough love I mentioned earlier. Surround yourself. Living a creative life also means leaving your studio and experiencing everything that's happening outside of those doors. Going to an art show, the theater, a poetry reading can leave you feeling totally inspired and invigorated. I've broken into a full-on sprint to get back to my studio after attending a beautiful art opening. Go to events, take classes, join creative groups. It sounds time-consuming, but it's also uplifting and is a step toward an enriching, creativity-filled life. While you're out there, look for an exciting chain of events. The more classes and happenings you attend, the larger your circle of creative cohorts becomes. Suddenly, you're not alone in your studio. You're experiencing new things. Finding your creative tribe. See Chapter 9, Creating in a Vacuum Sucks. And rushing home inspired to continue making. Procrastinate with purpose. Maybe you're not in the mood to be creative today. All right. But if you're going to procrastinate, procrastinate with purpose. Do something that you might consider creative housekeeping. For example, if my creative mojo has taken the day off, instead of throwing a tantrum and walking away, I start randomly cutting out bits and pieces from all of my thrift shop books. I have absolutely no intention of making something in this moment, but I know that at some point I will need all of these weird little images perfectly cut, so I might as well get it done. I actually find it relaxing, almost meditative. And the fantastic bonus? It totally gets my creative juices flowing. Suddenly, the girl with no plan is clearing the table, grabbing the glue, and making work until the wee hours of the morning. For you, this might be list making, or doodling, or a trip to the art store to grab a few supplies. You see an item or a color that screams your name, inspiration strikes, and new ideas start to flow. Take a moment to figure out how you can procrastinate with purpose. Then, the next time your mojo leaves town, you've got a plan. No more lies. Fear of failure, pointing fingers at the people and pets in your life, blaming conditions that aren't perfectly perfect, and procrastination with a capital P. I've told myself all sorts of lies. I can't even count how many times I've decided not to start on a project because the light wasn't quite right, or because my studio needed to be rearranged again. What a huge relief to learn that other people also tell themselves these ridiculous, creativity-halting lies. The secret is out. We've all admitted that we're a bunch of liars. It is officially time to stop making excuses and get on with being creative. The next time you feel you need to alphabetize the complete contents of your studio before you start working, think about this chapter. Remember that excuses are the enemy. Of course, you have to make time for your regular life, but you have to make time for your creative life too. If you tell yourself that being creative isn't important to you, that's the biggest lie yet. Chapter 3. Labels are for canned peaches, not people. Labels are sticky. They're great for organizing your cupboard, but when people put clingy, hard-to-remove labels on themselves, it can prevent creative growth. And sometimes, labels have incorrect information. That's why what's inside the can matters. Your inner critic may have slapped on any numbers of labels. Imposter, just a mom, cubicle dweller, self-taught amateur, art school dropout. It's time to get some warm, soapy water and start peeling those limiting labels off so that we can see what's actually inside. Warning, this label may stop you before you start. Before we talk about the contents of the canned goods, let's take a closer look at some of the most common labels. These are a handful of the stickiest culprits who, for some misguided reason, think they get to cover the entire surface of the can. Well, I'm sorry, but labels can't have that kind of real estate. You can be more than one thing at a time. You're not just a mom, a student, an accountant, a retired school teacher. You're so many things, including creative. Let's take a peek at the fine print. I'm a parent. This is big, but wearing this very important label doesn't mean that you can't be other things too. Being a parent can be all-consuming. It can also be, and will also be, exhausting. And when you're consumed and exhausted, it's likely that your art practice or even all of your creative urges will get pushed to the back burner. It's difficult to find time and energy for creative pursuits when you have your parental label on, but you will be a happier parent and a better one if you give yourself some time and space to be a creative person too. The key in this situation is speed. You don't have time for huge creative projects. Don't worry, you will again. So finding quick hits of creativity is what you need. An Instagram a day is a great place to start, because let's face it, you probably have your phone out to take zillions of photos of those sweet little faces in your life. There is a list of 30 jump starter ideas in Chapter 8 if you need a little help deciding what to photograph each day. Another thing that your artist soul will thank you for, 1 hour a week that is just for you. Not 1 hour to catch up on errands or sleep, but 1 hour to feed your creative needs. Ask your partner to stay with the kids or get a sitter. Now leave the house. Spend that weekly hour in a place that inspires you creatively. A gallery, a beautiful bookshop, an artsy cafe, the beach. Bring a notebook and jot down any thoughts that come to mind. As the kids get older, these outings can happen more frequently and last longer. And then, when you emerge from the sleep deprivation stage, you won't be starting from scratch. You will have enough of these inspiring hours under your belt that when you do have a bit more time, you'll be ready with an entire notebook full of starting points. I work in a cubicle. This just in, you can be a creative person who also works in a cubicle. It's true. All sorts of people have non-creative desk jobs and are insanely creative the minute the clock strikes 5. Whether you enjoy your day job or not, making time and space to be creative will bring you joy. You're probably tired at the end of a long day and the weight of your "I work in a cubicle" label may be dragging you down, but it should not be used as an excuse. It's as simple as this. If you want to create, make time to create. Schedule it. Use the program you book meetings with to book creative meetings with yourself. 30 minutes a day, 1 hour a day, whatever you can fit into that week. Mark Bradley Shoup, a practicing artist and a lecturer at the University of Tennessee, has some really smart advice for his students who are about to graduate. He tells them that, even once they have a full-time job, they also need to treat their studio practice like a job. It's not frivolous. It's important. He advises them to block off as many hours each week as can fit into their schedules, and then commit to being in the studio for that amount of time. No excuses. You show up on time to your desk job every day, and you need to show up on time for your creative life, too. I live in a tiny town. Hey, me too. And also, who cares? Thanks to the internet, the world has gotten a whole lot smaller. Publishers in New York can find you through your blog, and galleries in Paris can find you through your Instagram feed. I have to be honest, for a long time I worried that I wouldn't be taken seriously as an artist or curator unless I lived in a cool loft in Brooklyn. As much as I love New York, that delusional excuse isn't even close to the truth. Can you imagine if every creative person in the world lived on the same corner of the planet? Different places give different perspectives, no matter where you are. Own that perspective and see it as a strength. It's too late. You don't have to drop everything you've been doing for the last however many years, go back to college, write the next great fiction novel, or paint a masterpiece for the Louvre by next week. Start by adding 30 minutes of creativity to each day. That may mean one drawing per day, one photo per day, or even plating the perfect meal each evening. Whatever it is, make a tiny bit of time for this new creative endeavor. It may lead to an entirely new life that you didn't even know was waiting for you. I'm a fraud. No matter what field you're in, you may feel this way. It doesn't apply only to the creative world. Anytime you push yourself to do something new, something out of your comfort zone, you run the risk of feeling like a fraud or an imposter. What if people do find out that you weren't trained at the best culinary school in France? You just happen to be really good at making pastry. And this is not just an issue for self-taught people either. Someone with a BFA in painting might feel like a giant imposter if he/she decided to take up photography, or wedding planning, or even art curating. I was walking around with a giant imposter label on my forehead when I curated my first few shows. I don't have a PhD in curatorial studies. What if someone found out? They did. No one cared. I worked hard and loved what I was doing, and slowly but surely, the imposter label slid right off. Maybe it was all the sweat. Ask for help or fake it till you make it. Either way will work. If you love what you're doing, keep doing it. Eventually, you'll become an expert. These are a few of the most common labels that we slap on and may have a hard time seeing beyond. But, as you will see, there is so much more to each of us than these one-liners. Acknowledging and owning these labels is the first step in transforming them from creativity-halting excuses into a fascinating part of your unique story. You may be a parent from a small town who is also an insanely talented painter, or a self-taught musician who works in a cubicle by day and plays in blues clubs at night. Decide which part of the fine print you're proud of and which bits are slowing you down. This is a description of you, after all. Make sure that all of your information is included and correct. School. To go or not to go? That is the question. These next two labels are big. So big, in fact, that they need their very own section. They are the source of much debate and many unfounded insecurities. Ready? Self-taught. Here's a question. How can teaching yourself something new be a bad thing? It shows gumption, drive, and a desire to learn. Very admirable. So why do so many people treat self-taught like a four-letter word? I've heard very talented people say, "Well, I didn't go to school for this. It's just something I do on the side." So let me get this straight. If it didn't come with a certificate and a gold star, it doesn't count? That makes no sense. It sounds like an inner criticism to me. Here's the thing. Learning can happen anywhere if you are open to it. Just look at self-taught greats Paul Gauguin, Vincent van Gogh, Ernest Hemingway, and Prince, just to name a few. It's important to remember that every great, in every field, started out knowing absolutely nothing. Formally trained. Getting a formal education in something that you're passionate about is an amazing gift to give yourself. Years to focus on your work, surrounded by professors and peers to support your learning. Wonderful. But for some people, that diploma on the wall can act as a stop sign, holding them back from trying anything outside of what it says there. This even applies to people with BFAs under their belts. A highly educated, successful painter once told me, "I take photos, but I'm not a photographer. I mean, I didn't go to school for it or anything." If you have always gone the school route, and it's the way you feel most comfortable getting new skills, then embrace that. Sign up for classes, work with mentors, whatever works for you. But don't let that degree on the wall dictate your future. There are pros and cons to each of these routes. I decided to get insights from two incredibly creative people whose paths were very different. First, I spoke to Shauna Alterio, an insanely creative artist and designer from Philadelphia. She and her husband, Stephen Lloyd-Dolt, own a design business called Forage. They met while attending grad school at Cranbrook Academy of Art, coincidentally the same school where Charles and Ray Eames met. I wanted to know if having an MFA affects the creative life she leads today. This is what Shauna had to say. Danielle Crissa. What is the best thing that came out of your education? Shauna Alterio. Art school is a luxury that affords you time to do a lot of soul searching guided by mentors and peers. I have a group of girls that I collaborated with while at the Kansas City Art Institute, BFA, and they helped me discover my voice as an artist and a woman. I've had professors that I didn't sync well with, and that struggle developed my determined nature. And then there are the mentors who change the way you see the world. I was lucky enough to have two of them, Frances Resend and Carl Kurtz. They both recognized my crutches, my tricks of the trade, and pushed me outside of my comfort zone in a way that still impacts me today. DK, what's the most important thing you've learned on your own after your education, just by being creative every day? SA, just do it. Stop thinking about it, planning for it, and daydreaming. Take action and make your own opportunities. DK, do you have any advice for someone who is considering a BFA, MFA? SA, if it's the path for you, I think you know. There's no question, no rationalizing the lifelong debt. It's just what you have to do. DK, if you could do it all over again, would you go to art school? SA, yes. Even with $100K in student loan debt, yes. It was my path. It's how I arrived where I am today. It informed the person I am, my aesthetics, my approach to art and design. It's what I know. That doesn't mean it's the only way. It was just mine. Take action and make your own opportunities. That is some great advice. Now, let's talk to someone with a totally different experience. Someone who is self-taught and didn't even pick up a paintbrush until her early 30s. I spoke with artist and illustrator Lisa Congdon. Danielle Crissa. What did you study in college? Lisa Congdon. I studied history with an emphasis on recent American political history. DK. What made you decide to try art? Did you think or hope that it would become your career, or was it just for fun? LC. I was 31 when I first began dabbling in art making, and I did it as kind of a creative outlet outside of my job. I took some classes and really, really enjoyed the process of making art from start to finish. It was the most satisfying thing I had ever done. However, it was just a hobby for me for about 5 years, and my work was pretty terrible, at least looking back at it now. During those first few years, I never imagined I could sell one thing, much less make a living. I look back at that time in my life and think about where I am now, more than a decade later, and it is sort of mind-boggling. But about 5 years into it, I started getting inquiries about my work, about the stuff I was posting on Flickr and a blog that I kept at the time. I sold a few things here and there, though I never considered myself an artist. And then in 2005, I booked my first show, and everything changed. It was another 5 years before it was my full-time income, but that's when it all became a possibility. DK, what do you wish you'd learned when you first started making art full-time that could have saved you a lot of trouble? Elsie, get out of debt before you quit your day job and do a good job at keeping your financial books. I know this isn't a sexy answer, but getting your financial ducks in a row is important, and I didn't do it soon enough. I did do it eventually, a few years into my full-time art making, but I wish I had done it before I took this leap and not after. It would have saved me so much grief. It's expensive being a full-time artist. For example, if you're a sole proprietor, you have to pay self-employment tax, and you have to pay quarterly taxes based on the money you bring in. The more money you bring in, which is a goal, the more taxes you have to pay. You also have to pay for everything yourself. There is no boss to tell, I need new paintbrushes. It's sort of like owning your own home compared to renting and having a landlord. Awesome, yes, but totally filled with responsibilities and expenses. And so not having debt is something I wish I had thought more about before quitting my job. DK, how do you feel about being self-taught? Have you always felt the same about it, or has your perspective changed over the years? LC, I feel totally fine about being self-taught now, but for a long time I didn't. I have embraced my non-traditional path, starting later in life, being self-taught, but at first I felt like an imposter. I have come to learn that there is a term for that, imposter syndrome, and people from every field experience it. We think that despite our success, we are just lucky, or that we have deceived people somehow to believe our work is worthwhile. I feared I was going to get kicked out of the art club eventually because I didn't go to RISD, Rhode Island School of Design, or have the right training, and that people would eventually wise up and call me a fraud. I felt like an imposter even after my work became well-known and was selling, and I had a long roster of illustration clients. But eventually I wised up and decided that this way of thinking was not productive and complete bullshit. And I'm happy to say I do not feel like an imposter anymore. I value my self-taughtness now. I see that it has allowed me so much freedom from feeling restricted by or scared of breaking rules that exist in the world of art and illustration. It has benefited me greatly. DK, have you found any mentors in your self-taught journey? LC, there were several people who encouraged me and gave me solid advice early on. My first illustration agent, Lila Rogers, was one person who really mentored me when I was starting out. She taught me so much about the worlds of licensing and illustration. I will always value what she taught me, and I also value what a wonderful colleague and supporter she continues to be. My former studio mate, painter Jamie Vasta, was also a great mentor to me. She had gone through rigorous art school training and was so knowledgeable about composition and technique and gave useful feedback on my paintings, in particular. She also asked me for feedback on her work, which made me feel so valid in a way no one had ever made me feel before. I owe so much to her as well. There are so many women, in particular, who have gone before me on this path and been so generous with their time and knowledge. DK, if you could do it all over again, would you go to art school? LC, art school can be enormously valuable, but my life has been a magical mix of so many different experiences, and mostly I wouldn't trade that for anything. And now, in my 40s, I have this thing that I love to do and that I can make a living at. It's given the second half of my life meaning it wouldn't have had otherwise. Anyone who discovers a new skill or joy or talent later in life should see this as a gift, not a hindrance. So I think my path was meant to be, just the way it was. Also, it's never too late for me to go back to get my MFA. Though I'm not sure I'd ever be able to slow down enough to make that happen. For now, I'm very happy with what I'm doing and very happy with how I got here. Shauna and Lisa are both proof that training can come from so many different places. If you want to learn something new, go learn something new. Set yourself up to get this new skill in whichever way suits you best. You are what you know, regardless of when and where you did the learning. The School of Life. Regardless of whichever path you've chosen, completely self-taught or a formal education, there is a long, exciting road of learning that lies ahead. In the School of Life, there is no exam to pass or fail that deems you creative or not. Not only is there no exam, there is also no template to follow. You have to do what feels right to you. And creating your own path is not only perfectly acceptable, it's also mandatory. There may not be a detailed map to follow, but there is one very simple common thread that connects every successful creative person. Hard work. The only place where success comes before work is in the dictionary. I love this quote. It's been attributed to many different people, from Mark Twain to football coach Vince Lombardi, but whoever coined it was right. Whichever path you choose, in order to find success, you have to work hard, be committed, and never, ever quit, even when your inner critic tells you to. Fill the can. We've removed those sticky, incorrect labels. Now what? Time to look at the contents of this label-free can. Do you know what's in there? Are you a poet, a painter, a dancer? Maybe all of the above? There's a lot of fun in figuring that out. I have an assignment for you. List 5 creative activities that you've always wanted to try. Things for which you have no formal training. If you're a writer, maybe it's painting. If you're a painter, perhaps it's weaving. Pick one and try it within the next 7 days. Then repeat with another activity you've always wanted to do and repeat until you've done all five. It's fine to start small. The internet is rife with DIYs, training videos, etc. There are so many generous people out there willing to share what they know, so take advantage of that. The next step up from that would be online courses. These range in price and outcome, but there are a lot of them out there, and they're worth looking into. Keep in mind that some trickier mediums will require signing up for an actual instructor-led course. No self-taught glass-blowing, please. New and improved. The old labels are gone, the can is full, and you've started to gather a complete list of ingredients that go into making you the creative person that you are. You now have a brand new, custom-designed label that you can display proudly as you head down your own creative path. In Chapter 1, Everyone is Creative, artist Trey Spiegel explained how he began owning his creative title. Claiming the title you want, artist, writer, musician, etc., is a huge first step in living a creative life. Now that you've put on the correct label, own it. Be proud of your contents. During a block or after getting some unhelpful criticism, you may be tempted to slap that old label back on. Don't. Show people this new improved version and let them know that you are so much more than just that old sticky label. Chapter 4. Blank paper can be blinding. Blank paper is so full of hope and excitement. The possibilities are endless. And therein, of course, lies the problem. The possibilities are endless. What are the rules? There aren't any? Uh-oh. What should you put on that big, perfect white canvas? Which of your words should be written in that pristine, empty notebook? Even if you have a zillion ideas, getting them out of your head and down onto that precious white space may be insanely intimidating for just about anyone. Luckily, there are many ways to work around that blinding glare. We'll hear perspectives from professional artists about how they stare down the blank page, and because there is no such thing as too many lists, I've also included a top 10 set of rules for making all those possibilities a little less daunting. White paper intimidates me, and I don't like being intimidated. Martha Rich. Don't let paper push you around. I used to fill my studio with perfect white canvases. They were perfect, and I was terrified to ruin them. Hey, those weren't cheap, and as soon as you put the first stroke down, you destroy their perfectness. You should just give up before you start. Go on, put that canvas back on the shelf so you don't ruin it with your dumb ideas and obvious lack of painting skills. Jerk. So, I bought a sketchbook instead. I thought I'd paint in that because there would be less pressure. I chose a gorgeous red linen-bound book with thick white paper. It's actually still on my studio shelf, completely blank. Still too precious. Then I discovered the work of American artist Martha Rich. She paints on found bits of paper and on the pages of old books. Brilliant. The next time I was at my local thrift shop, I bought a Woman's Encyclopedia of Cookery from 1964 for 50 cents. Suddenly, I wasn't so precious about the pages. If I'd felt I'd ruined one, I ripped it out and kept going. Sometimes I'd paint around the giant, badly photographed pineapple ham that was featured in the recipe and make it part of my composition. This new approach gave me a creative, weird, delicious place to start. And these pieces that were meant to be studies actually turned into final works that I framed, hung, and am still proud of today. It was a miracle. I shared this story with Martha a few years after she'd given me that great quote about intimidating white paper. It turned out that years after working as a full-time artist, she was no longer bothered by white pages. She told me that she'd become totally comfortable starting a new piece on a clean sheet. I think that's because she now knows who she is as an artist and what her style is. Also, she's incredibly good at just going for it. She's not precious about pieces. If her drawing isn't working, she flips the paper over and tries again. No big deal. Just as I was starting to feel impressed, and a little bit jealous, that she's managed to get herself to this wondrous place, she added, "Oh, but I would never work on a big white canvas. Now that is scary." Embrace creative potholes. Naturally, Martha's comment got me thinking about big white canvases, BWCs. Let's face it, their unmarked surface can be very intimidating. What happens if the wrong line, or a splash or stroke, finds its way onto that perfection? Will it be a disaster of epic proportions? So many people worry about exactly that. What about artists who actually work on BWCs every day? Do they live in a constant state of terror? Fingernails bitten down to the cuticle? Night sweats? Their inner critic laughing hysterically at their expense?